It's Wednesday, November the 3rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Last Saturday, Sinn Féin held its annual Ardesh in the Helix Theatre in Dublin, and most media attention focused on the party's decision to end its opposition to non-jury courts, such as the Special Criminal Court, in circumstances where they are deemed necessary due to the risk of jury intimidation or for other reasons. It is significant in itself as it represents the ending of a policy which has its roots in the party's own history as an advocate for so-called armed struggle, which often saw Republicans being prosecuted by those very same courts. So what does that decision and the general tenor of the conference this year tell us about where exactly Sinn Féin is at as it makes its preparations for what many expect will be an historic entry into government after the next election? Our political correspondent Jennifer Bray wrote an in-depth analysis of this very question a couple of days ago in the Irish Times, and it's fair to say it's a subject which has also been preoccupying our political editor, Pat Leahy, and they're both here to discuss it today. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Top of the morning to you, Hugh.
Jen, I'll go to you first, and we'll look at the nitty-gritty, which you look at in the piece, which is numbers, constituencies, the number of seats the party could reasonably expect to achieve on the basis of the kind of poll results it's getting right now. And you did a breakdown of that. Where can Sinn Féin hope or aspire to get to after the next election in terms of numbers of seats in the Dáil?
Yeah, no, I think obviously there's all of these projections are always, you know, very heavily caveated in that this is a snapshot in a moment in time. If the polls translated into reality and if the trajectory continued as it is at the moment. So taking that as it is, and also depending on, you know, what transpires over the next couple of years. But at this moment in time, I kind of just went through a couple of the different constituencies and looked at their numbers and tried to figure out what is the actual trajectory that they are on now if there was an election called sooner rather than later. So we know that in February 2020, which I still cannot believe is last year because it honestly feels like 10 years ago. But anyway, they, you know, had a really fantastic day. They had won 37 seats. It was really seismic, and we've gone through that, you know, many's the time. And if we look at the polls at the moment, I mean, our most recent poll showed that Sinn Féin has taken this 10-point lead over Fine Gael, and it's their highest rating ever in the series. So I think it is fair to assume that the trend is most certainly there. Now, if we look at the actual numbers, so they, you know, they have at the moment 37, you know, we know that a Dáil majority at the moment, there's 160 seats and Dáil would be 80 plus one. You know, they're still a very long way off that. But on my analysis at present, they could get to, I think, or up to around 55 seats if there were an election before the end of the year, maybe even 60 if they had the right candidate strategy and the right voting strategies in different constituencies. Now, we can get into a little bit more later on about how that's obviously short of the number that they need and how would they bridge that gap. But there are constituencies which are really obvious, you know, that you can imagine they would view as a done deal. Like, you know, think, for example, of Dublin Central. So that's Mary Lou McDonald's constituency, obviously. Now, Sinn Féin obviously did not expect to do as well as they did, because if they had expected and they had known that they would have run a second candidate there and in many other places, in some places, maybe even a third candidate. So there is a place where they would look to, you know, basically Mary Lou McDonald, she topped the poll. She had more than 11,000 first preference votes. So that's a place where they would look to add a second seat, you know, on her. On the back of her sales. So then you obviously have got Dublin Bay North, loads of areas in Dublin, but in Dublin Bay North, you know, Denise Mitchell, her figures in 2020 were incredible. You know, I had to go back and double check this because I thought it was a mistake when I was writing it. I'd forgotten that she actually crossed the line of more than 21,000 votes, which was 9,409 over the quota. So, I mean, there's another place where they will be looking, you know, to get the right candidate in and add another person into a Dáil seat. What I was looking at in these kind of constituencies and other constituencies around the country is what seats would they be targeting? Where is it that they would expect to make gains? And who made gains off them the last time round? And we know that there are a lot of candidates on the left who did really, really well from Sinn Féin transfers, even independent candidates and left-leaning independent candidates did quite well in different constituencies. So somewhere like this in Dublin Bay North, you could imagine that Cian O'Callaghan and the Sock Dems, that would be the seat or that kind of seat that they would be hoping would be vulnerable and would be looking to take, even though the Sock Dems are kind of holding steady at the polls, relatively speaking. I was interested too in constituencies where they might think about a three candidate strategy. Now, we know for a whole load of reasons that a three candidate strategy can be dodgy. It can split the vote, you know, and it doesn't always work out. And in fact, they've learned that before, I think. So in Donegal, they took 45% of the first preference vote in 2020. And, you know, they got Pearse Doherty there and Pádraig McLoughlin. And they will be, I hear that there is a lot of wrangling internally in the party about whether they should run a third candidate or not. But, you know, the hope that they would have is that they'd run these two well-known, Pearse Doherty obviously very well-known, Pádraig McLoughlin's well-known candidates, and then a third candidate will come in, if even on the back of kind of surpluses and transfers. So that's what they would be looking at there. Then I was interested too in Cork, because obviously, you know, many people would say Cork is the real capital. I'm not going to go there because obviously I'm a dub. But we'll be looking at Cork North Central. They would be looking to add a seat on top of Thomas Gould's. Again, who would they be targeting? Maybe PBP's Mick Barry. Cork East, you know, where Pat Buckley did really well the last time. And then Cork North West, where there's two Fianna Fáil seats, Andreas Moynihan and Michael Moynihan. And the chat is that maybe they would view one of those seats as being, you know, given Fianna Fáil's numbers, not a sure bet for them, and possibly is where Sinn Féin can make inroads. And we have to remember that they are running Leonie Rida in this constituency. And I'm sure she wished she had a run the last time, to be honest. But, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing and all that. And yeah, so, you know, this same pattern kind of holds through in different constituencies all across the country. And I think, like I said, if you add them all up and you come to the numbers, I'd be looking at 55 to 60 seats at present. Now, I could be totally wrong. Who knows? But
no, I mean, it looks pretty persuasive to me. Pat, can I just draw out a couple of conclusions that I would take from what Jen was describing there? There are some constituencies like the Cork East one she mentions, where I think it's just they are remaining pockets of the country where Sinn Féin doesn't have a seat yet, and if it's rising to be the largest party in the country, it can reasonably expect to be competing for a seat the next time out. But what's a more prevalent pattern? Dublin Central, Dublin Bay North, Cork North Central, is these seats which it left behind the last time. There was quite a lot of talk of a vote left strategy, I remember, before the last election, and the parties who benefited from that strategy, from those transfers, were People Before Profit, to some extent the Social Democrats. And Sinn Féin is going to want to eat all their lunch the next time out, it seems clear to me. And I wonder what that means about relationships between those parties over the next 2 years and how the campaign plays out when it comes to it. Does the vote left strategy fall apart under that strain?
Well, it won't do anything for the relationships, you would imagine, if you know, as many of those TDs in this, whose seats Sinn Féin will be targeting, you know, it'll be as obvious to them as it is to us. But in a way, the relations between the left-wing parties matter less this side of the election than they will the far side of the election. And, you know, I think what you have to look at once you know, to digest the implications of Jen's pretty acute analysis of where the seats might fall for them, the implications that are to try and figure out what is their route to government. You know, it seems to me that there's two possible routes to government for Sinn Féin after the next election. One is at the head of a left-led coalition, which would, you know, make the magic 80 plus numbers between Sinn Féin, Left Independence, the Labour Party, the Social Democrats, maybe People Before Profit, Solidarity as well, and potentially the Green Party. Now, you know, we could go on to talk about the viability of that coalition in a bit, but it is certainly true that if Sinn Féin is gaining seats at the expense of other left-wing parties, then that doesn't necessarily bring the prospect of a left-led coalition any closer, if you know what I mean. And the other route to government for Sinn Féin then is a potential coalition with Fianna Fáil. But if what you're interested in is a left-led coalition, then Sinn Féin needs to take the seats of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are of rural independence rather than other left-wing TDs, which is, you know, where many of those seats, as Jen points out, are likely to fall to them.
I mean, another part of this, Jen, which you refer to, is that is, I suppose, the problems of success. As a party gets much bigger, it has to find more candidates. There can be difficulty in, you know, maintaining perhaps a quality threshold in relation to those. And there's the never-ending problem for larger parties in the Irish political system of internecine quarrels about who gets nominated and who gets which part of the constituency, which aren't a problem if you're a smaller party with one candidate per constituency, but are a big one. And then you add to that the fact that gender quotas, the requirement for a minimum of 40% candidates next time out in terms of the gender split, is going to put additional pressure on this. And these things can cause big trouble for parties, can't they? And they can end up losing seats if they get it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And that part of the puzzle, that the candidate selection obviously is something that they have been working on since February 2020. And they are in the process of, around the country, looking at their tickets and figuring out, you know, who goes where. Yeah, so if you look somewhere like Limerick County, where the party probably be targeting those seats that Pat was talking about, independent seats, you know, like Richard O'Donoghue, they had a councillor there who came close to winning a seat for the party in the last election. And then we heard, I think it was our colleague Harry McGee had a piece about this edict that came down from party headquarters that only a female candidate will be allowed to stand in that constituency in the next election. And the reason why is obvious, because Sinn Féin is the same as all other political parties, will have to increase the number of women on the ticket. And that is because from 2023, the gender quota, which was 30% in 2020, in the last election will rise to 40%. And that obviously puts pressure on political parties, because this isn't a matter of, you know, an arbitrary figure. You know, if you don't hit that figure, the party risks losing state funding. So there, this won't be the only constituency where we see this happen. I mean, that is it's a really high figure, especially when you consider that when Sinn Féin ran their last slew of candidates, you know, there is a real suspicion that they didn't suspect that a lot of those candidates would actually get elected. It'll have to be different, I think, the next time around. I think there'll have to be obviously much more consideration put into the candidates and how they would fare in debates and even in their local media debates, because the questions that will be asked of the candidates the next time around, I think will be a different vein, because this time the party, maybe if it's looking at itself as a government in waiting, then the public and the media and all other, you know, branches of Irish society will be looking at them in similar veins. So the questions, I think, will be different. It will be more like, well, what will you do? Or what could you do? Rather than sort of more abstract ideals. So that'll be a big part of the puzzle, I suppose. How do you get that figure up to make sure you maintain all your state funding without putting other noses out of joint for candidates who previously expected to run, while also making sure you have the requisite number of candidates in ticket, because I believe they want to run up to an extra 30 candidates at least.
I mean, the other challenge for the party, Pat, which Jen points out in her article, is in order to increase its overall vote and move out from its, you know, its traditional core base of working class voters and young voters and certain other sections of society, it needs to appeal to people who previously exhibited resistance to Sinn Féin for whatever reason, both in terms of increasing its share of the overall first preferences, or maybe just as importantly also to have some chance at transfers from some of those voters, because traditionally one of the drags on Sinn Féin's results was a sort of a transfer resistance among some parts of the population. The polls are quite good on that, aren't they? That traditional resistance among, say, middle-class voters does seem to be ebbing away to some extent.
It's waning amongst middle-class voters, and it's particularly waning among young middle-class voters. And it's waning, and you can see it, you can track it in the polls. If you look at them, look at it over time, it's how that resistance is waning right across the board at a greater pace in some demographic than others. And this, of course, is the nature of Irish electoral competition, that, you know, relatively small numbers of votes are so valuable that this, and the imperative for all parties is not just to have get people to vote for them, but not to regard them as toxic, not to stay away from them, not to avoid transferring to them down towards the middle of the ballot paper, because that may be the difference, in a handful of seats, in a handful of constituencies. The margins are so tight in Irish electoral politics that this impels candidates and parties to try to avoid annoying people. And that is one of the things that drags everybody into the centre in Irish electoral politics. And I guess we are seeing some of those similar dynamics at play with Sinn Féin at the moment. The balance that the party will have to strike over the next couple of years is to retain its campaigning zeal, its left-wing edge, its radical policies that appeal to so many younger voters, while at the same time smoothing off maybe the rough edges that have scared off middle-class voters and older voters who, let us not forget, vote in greater numbers than proportionately than young people. So that's the balance, I think, that the party will have to strike over the coming years. And as it does that, to project itself, and I was writing about this a couple of weeks ago, that suddenly you've started to notice the phrase Sinn Féin in government, or in government Sinn Féin would, in all the statements and soundbites that party spokesmen are now making. That phrase, and it was all over the place at the Ardéis last weekend, not just in Mary Lou McDonald's speech, but in all the speeches and soundbites that were given by party spokesmen. This projecting themselves as the government in waiting, while striking that balance between maintaining their radicalism but trying not to scare off voters in the middle class and older age brackets. That's the challenge for the party over the coming years.
And Joan, you've made some very interesting observations on this. You know, clearly it's a huge challenge for a party which has never been in government in the history of this state to present itself as a credible, as the credible party to lead the next government. There's an advantage because, of course, they are presenting themselves as change agents, and that's the good side of it. The bad side is that none of them have any actual experience in government at all. And you offer a couple of examples of how key frontbench spokespeople in areas like health and housing are sort of reaching out and building bridges or building their credibility as people who could well be ministers in 2 or 3 years' time.
Yeah, they definitely are. And it's easier, I think, when you're in opposition to do that, because obviously you can promise the earth, moon and the stars to whatever, you know, advocacy group or interest group or representative group without actually having to take the flak of making the decision, which often doesn't quite work out that way, as we know from what it's actually like from witnessing different careers in government and in cabinet. So, you know, I took the example, I think, of David Cullinan, who covers the health portfolio for Sinn Féin. And, you know, he earlier, I think it was in October, launched the party's alternative health budget. And, you know, we went along, we're asking him questions about it or whatever. And one of the key promises that the party made was to introduce an Irish National Health Service and to sort of take that, you know, the way the private sector is so heavily embedded in the public system, and to separate those and basically create that system. We were asking him, you know, like, how do you actually plan to do that, given we've heard many of the promise about universal healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. And he was saying, you know, well, I had a meeting with Robert Watt and I sat down with him and I asked him, would this be possible? And he said it was possible. All that requires is political will.
And money.
And money. Well, there's that. But it was an interesting, you know, the way he kind of, you know, the image that he puts out of him meeting with, you know, very senior civil servants and talking about massive reforms to the health service and how people on the inside would very much back his plans. But, you know, what's also interesting, I think, is before he launched that budget, he met with 100 of the different groups, you know, whether it be the Irish Heart Foundation or the Irish Cancer Society or the INMO, all the big groups in health, and on a conference call. And what I was told is did a bit of digging around to see, you know, what was the response. And it was apparently very good. And they were urging him to, you know, stick with the policies that he was advocating for in his document, but to go further. And he was apparently saying, well, you know, we have to be realistic here. So it was an interesting insight into that. So, of course, they are building bridges. And there was one comment that someone who is very seasoned deals with all of these groups made. And they were talking about basically how people who crossed the road before to get away from the Shinners were now kind of leaping at the chance to have meetings with them and have conversations with them. And there was an interesting, I think, thing that Cullinan did, which tallies with that, which would be that the Irish Hospital Consultants Association last month also had their annual conference and they had David Cullinan in to speak at it. And they're regarded as very kind of hard to win over group. And, you know, wouldn't always be a big fan of the policies being posited by various different people in government and outside government. So that was kind of interesting. And even Eoin O'Brien, who obviously is, when he talks and when he does press conferences, he says, you know, if I were the Minister for Housing instead of Dara O'Brien, which I really wish was the case, what would I say to you? You know, that's literally what he says. Just I think that he has his fans. I know he has his fans, actually, in the Department of Housing. And I know for a fact that there are people in there who would very much like it if he was in as the Minister for Housing. So he has, what I'm saying is that the TDs, the senior ones, they do have backing and they are working on that behind the scenes and they are very much preparing for a life in which they ideally would be in government. And like Pat says, you hear that all the time now. If I was standing here instead of blah, 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 here's what I will be doing, etc., which is, sounds great, but, you know, and like, let's see if it happens. If they do get in, it'll be fascinating.
I mean, I find that line about the Department of Housing and feeling in there in favour of Eoin O'Brien as a future minister, I found that fascinating and quite telling. There is, of course, the danger, isn't there, Pat? And I presume Sinn Féin are very aware of this, of over-promising and under-delivering. You only have to look at Labour's experience post-2011 to see that, you know, that can actually create a rod for your own back politically, which can end up being disastrous. When they're in power, the shine can go off very quickly. If, for example, David Cullinan hasn't delivered a universal national health service within the term of the government, which seems unlikely to me.
Yeah, but I think the party is kind of aware of that, you know, and as well as reaching out to stakeholders, talking to the civil service about how it might implement their plans and that sort of thing, which the party is doing. It's also studying the experience of kind of the failure of fellow European left populist parties like Podemos, like Syriza, once they got into government and found, as all oppositions do when they get into government, that, oops, it's not quite as straightforward as we might have thought. So I think what you will see the party do as the next election becomes closer is try to be realistic about its promises in government and saying things like, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have made such a bags of this for the last 100 years that it's going to take us more than one term to fix all these problems. That's what one would expect them to do. I mean, I think we'll be able to look at, you know, two vital strands of Sinn Féin's government project, and I suppose this is important for the construction of any coalition as well, because unless we assume that, as we said earlier, unless we, you know, there's two possible routes to government, both of them involving coalitions, and unless we assume that Sinn Féin can win an overall majority, which I'm prepared to predict now that they won't do, then you're talking about negotiations on a programme for government. So if you look at those two strands then of a Sinn Féin governing project, which would be, I think, you know, the left-wing economic prospectus that would see a much greater role for the state, higher taxes on some people, higher spending in areas like health. And all of that, as I say, left-wing, broadly social democrat, left social democratic prospectus. You hear Sinn Féin spokesman talking about, you know, comparisons with other social democratic European governments, that sort of thing. And allied to that then is the great project for many people in Sinn Féin, the broader Republican movement, which is the push for a united Ireland. And in some ways, that would be the greater change in government in Dublin once Sinn Féin was part of that government, to reorient the Irish government's policy towards the, you know, constant, aggressive push for a united Ireland. I mean, aggressive in the sense that it's something that they're pushing for every day, every week, in every part of government policy. And that, I think, would be a huge change, perhaps a greater change than many people realise. And it will also be, I think, something that the other parties to the Sinn Féin-led coalition, whatever they will be, whether it's Fianna Fáil or the left-wing parties. That is something that they will have to think long and hard about before they join, that nationalist element to the Sinn Féin government project.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, the other thing that always strikes me about Sinn Féin, Jen, is their ruthless pragmatism and strategic thinking. And I mean that in a complimentary way, because that's the way a political party should go about its business if it's serious about achieving power. And one does hear quite a lot of talk on the left, as Pat says, about the example of, say, somewhere like Portugal, which has had a fairly successful coalition of disparate left-wing parties over the last 5 years or so. I think I was reading this weekend that it's running into trouble right now. But putting on a pragmatic, strategic hat and looking at the options after an election, and I know we're just kind of, you know, we're guessing at what the numbers would be. I'm not sure I'd want to be relying on Thomas Pringle and Richard Boyd Barrett and a gang of other disparate people, two or three other small parties, to achieve a stable government that I could rely on lasting for 4 or 5 years. I feel I might be far more attracted to getting a party, one more party, which gets me over the line. And I think it's pretty unlikely that party's going to be Fine Gael. So it looks like Fianna Fáil to me.
Well, you know, we are nothing if we are not pragmatic and strategic on the political team. So let me put my pragmatic strategic hat on. Yeah, I agree. And I think obviously as well, if they're targeting, or even if they're not targeting, if they do sweep up some of those left seats from smaller parties and independents, that obviously it lessens their idea or their route to power if that was to involve, you know, a coalition of the left. So what were the options, or what would be the options if they couldn't manage? And, you know, always remember that Enda Kenny, everyone doubted that he would ever manage to get, as some people called him at the time, not me, a ragbag of independents together to form his minority government. And he did it. So, you know, politics is the art of the possible and all that. But I suppose if we're looking at it pragmatically, honestly, like, you would have to think that the moment their clearest path to government will be a coalition with Fianna Fáil. And you know, I'm sure some people would hear that and think, well, that's not going to happen, you know. But actually, before the last election, you know, we were ringing around grassroots across the country, talking to TDs on background. And there was actually a lot more support there for talking to Sinn Féin, even in the first instance, let alone, you know, going fully down that road. And myself and Cormac McQuinn did a survey of the Fianna Fáil TDs after the election and asked them, you know, do you think the party should have talked to Sinn Féin? And do you think the party should be open to talking to Sinn Féin after the next election? And I expected that, I don't really know what I expected, but I didn't expect as many people in the party to say what they said, which was that they absolutely should be open to having that conversation. A lot of them, I can't remember the exact figures off the top of my head, but I think it was the vast majority of the people who we surveyed on and off the record for that piece. And that's at a parliamentary party level. And I have talked to people in the grassroots, so not in a while, about the prospect of a Sinn Féin coalition. And in Fianna Fáil, I genuinely think there is more support for it than maybe people suspect. Whether that support exists in Sinn Féin, I mean, if the question is, this is your only route to power, and if they are serious about power, as they've always talked about being excluded, if they're included this time in the conversation, it's much more difficult for them to say no. You know, it was a different ballgame the last time because Fianna Fáil wouldn't talk to them, Fine Gael wouldn't talk to them. We know what happened there. Next time will be different. So it will be fascinating. But at this moment in time, if we go in the figures now, and if this was at the end of the year, I would say that would be their most viable entrance to government.
Do you agree, Pat?
Yeah, I do. Looking at it at this point, the most likely route to government for Sinn Féin is with Fianna Fáil in coalition, because I find it very difficult to see the numbers coming together for a left-led coalition. Once you exclude, as I think you would have to, some of the left-wing independents and smaller parties that wouldn't necessarily want to be in coalition. You might also have to include the Labour Party as well. I was talking to some Labour Party people recently about whether they would be able to swallow the nationalist United Ireland part of the Sinn Féin government prospectus. They said, you know, no way. They wouldn't be able, whatever the rest of the party might do as well. So I think if you look at the numbers at the moment and you say, where are, you know, what is the realm of the possible of where they might go, then I think, yes, the most likely route to government for Sinn Féin is in coalition with Fianna Fáil. So could that happen? How would it go down in both parties? Could Fianna Fáil swallow the nationalist United Ireland element of the Sinn Féin programme for government? That would require, I think, a pretty profound discussion within the party about where it sees itself in regard to that question. Luckily, the party will have the opportunity for just such a reflection when it elects its next leader, which we all assume will be at some stage between the period when Micheál Martin leaves the office of Taoiseach in a little over 12 months' time and the following election. So I think that will be a really interesting part of that discussion within Fianna Fáil, and, you know, about whether it could go into coalition with Sinn Féin, and on what terms, how does the party face up to that question of a push for a united Ireland, and on what terms? And I think that will form part of the internal discussion that the party has as well. But it's also a question for Sinn Féin, who will have campaigned for years and years and years to get Fianna Fáil out, to throw the old firm out of government, and then all of a sudden only to turn around and go, well, you know what, we're going to put them back in. They're not just such bad fellas after all. They've agreed to most of the things we want to do, not all, but we've had, you know, several negotiating sessions with them. You know, we've had many cups of coffee with them. We even went out for pints with them one night, and that turns out, you know, we can do business with them in government. And how would Sinn Féin's young, new, left-wing, radical support base react, many of whom have, you know, joined the party in recent years with the explicit intention of kicking out the old firm out of government? How would they react to that? There was an interesting piece by the UCD academic Aidan Regan in the Business Post on Sunday, in which he sketched out precisely this scenario, and he predicted that this, you know, when they inevitably make this jump, that Sinn Féin would lose the support of many of those younger left-wing, radically inclined supporters for the great betrayal of putting Fianna Fáil back into government. And you can just imagine what both Sinn Féin's opponents on the left and Fine Gael would be saying in opposition to that government. But, you know, the question, you know, the choice for Sinn Féin is, you know, power or not. And power comes with compromises. That's the nature of politics.
I think Aidan Regan is absolutely right in his analysis of Sinn Féin losing some of that left-wing support once it entered into government. In fact, I think more broadly, Sinn Féin might face all kinds of interesting challenges for the kind of broad coalition it now represents holding that together once it's actually in government. But that's obviously a challenge they're willing to accept. But finally, Jen, I'd just like to ask you, we've predicated this entire conversation on a sort of a sense of inevitability that Sinn Féin will be by far the largest party after the next election and then will inevitably have to be the lead party in government. Is there anything that could derail that process now, that could make the inevitable not inevitable? What could go wrong between now and the election to make that not happen?
Listen, if I knew all of that, I would have back-to-back front page yarns for you for the next, up until Christmas.
I expect nothing less.
Well, you know, I don't know. But no, it's a good question. And look, the honest answer is anything could go wrong. You know, anything at all could go wrong. But obviously, if we're looking specifically at Sinn Féin, there's still so many legacy issues there. And there's still a lot of issues that have not been addressed. And I think the party sometimes thinks that because Mary Lou McDonald has taken over from Gerry Adams, that this kind of is a cleaner slate there for younger voters. But as Pat points out, you know, it is older voters who tend to vote in larger amounts. And there are still many people, I think, who would be very reluctant to vote Sinn Féin and who don't really feel that, you know, there are still a lot of things unaddressed and that need to be explained. So, you know, that whole area, I think, is still tricky for them and will continue to be tricky.
But that's essentially baked in, isn't it? You know, that's baked into all our calculations that we've been talking about, that there is that portion of the electorate that still has those reservations and that resistance to Sinn Féin. But given all that, the numbers are still the numbers as we see them at the moment.
The numbers are still the numbers, yeah. I mean, the other thing you'd have to think that this will be predicated on would be the success or failure of government in achieving what they said they would achieve when they set out in the summer when they had their programme for government. So I think that, you know, obviously housing, and we've talked about this so many times, because it is the big ticket issue, well, one of the big ticket issues. And you'd have to imagine a scenario whereby if they don't make inroads, and because of COVID, I think it's really, really dealt a hammer blow to their ambitions to build, you know, up to 30,000 houses a year, which is just not going to happen until later, later in the decade. So obviously the success or failure of the government in terms of their policy will have a big implication on Sinn Féin and whether they can continue to use the platform that they have now and the examples and the issues that they do. To me, that's one of the biggest, I suppose, things that we would keep an eye on. Like I said, the legacy issues as well. And then there's just always the unknown in politics. Stuff just happens. Banana skins are everywhere. You literally cannot look around the corner and know what might happen for any political party. That applies to Sinn Féin, that applies to Fianna Fáil, all of them. So we'll have to wait and see. I'm sure Pat would have much more insight into this than me.
Yeah, there's a certain black comedy, Pat, isn't there? The idea that, you know, that this government might finally get its act together on housing, but it might be the next government, which might be led by Sinn Féin, that would actually benefit from that, or that people might feel the effects of it during the course of a Sinn Féin government. But I suppose that's one of the never-ending ironies of politics and how long things take to get done and who actually gets credit for them in the end. But it's still hard to see this government managing to turn the ship to such a radical degree over the next 3 years that it somehow really not just stems but turns around this tide towards Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think if you look at some of the things that are driving that, you know, the housing crisis, dissatisfaction with the waiting lists in the health service and various other public services, the housing shortage, of course, the most acute thing. But and that will be ameliorated to some degree by the time the next election comes, assuming present government lasts until early 2025, but it's not going to be solved. I suspect it's not going to be completely solved by, you know, the end of the following government either. So I suppose the question is for this government is whether it can demonstrate significant progress. That's the best it can hope for, and take the edge off the real anger that many people, you know, particularly those under 35, under 40, who feel shut out, you know, middle-income workers who feel shut out of the prospect of owning their own house. Now, can the government make progress, sufficient progress on that? Well, that is to some degree in their own hands. But, you know, you look at other things like just the sheer unpredictability of you know, international affairs at the moment, and how that might play into to domestic politics. We appear to be heading into a period of fairly strong inflation. I mean, imagine what happens in this country if interest rates start ticking up by a couple of points by central banks, you know, and at the same time fuel prices continued their increase. I mean, that's a real cost of living squeeze and income squeeze on middle income people. That will, of course, have political events. But it's not all one way traffic either. The economy is currently growing at a spectacular rate, so incomes will be growing, jobs will be created. You know, the economic fortunes of the country is one of the tectonic plates of politics, and that is operating in the government's medium term benefit at the moment, and CASP can't be discounted. All of which is a rather long winded way of saying, I suppose, that who the hell knows where the political landscape is in 3 and a bit years' time. I mean, don't forget, even in relation to Sinn Féin, you know, 6 or 8 months before the last general election, the party had a disastrous day in the local and European elections, which is one of the reasons why it didn't run enough candidates in the last general election, because it was trying to hold on to the seats that it had. A week before the election was called, Sinn Féin was still trimming its tickets, removing candidates because it feared it was running too many candidates and would end up losing seats. So, you know, things can turn around very, very quickly. But and there's also one further point, I suppose, if you believe that, as most Sinn Féin supporters and many other left-wing supporters of left-wing parties appear to do, that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are essentially the same party, then that essentially the same party is 10 points ahead of Sinn Féin in the opinion polls. So, you know, I don't think that a Sinn Féin government is inevitable. I think nothing is inevitable in politics. It is at this point, by some distance, the most likely outcome of the next election, but it is not inevitable.
Right, we'll put away our crystal balls for now, though, because there's only so much prediction you can do, but I'm sure we'll be doing more of it over the next weeks and months ahead. Anyway, regardless. But thanks for the moment to Jen and to Pat, and to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, our engineer, JJ Vernon. We're going to be back with you very soon. Remember, you can mail us with your thoughts or your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.